Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, September 22nd, 2023. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I'm joined by Carl Hamers, a regular contributor to the magazine and author of Covert COVID Culprits. All right, Carl Hamers, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
Excellent, John. Good to be with you again.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I was actually just looking at the archives before we started recording today, and this is our seventh podcast together. So thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me as always. You are, of course, a regular contributor to the Barnes Review History Magazine, and I know your work has also been featured and published in the past at the Occidental Observer. It's also at the UNS Review, and you maintain your own Substack page, which I follow via email. It's called Taboo Truth, and you authored a book that was published earlier this year, which is currently available from the Barnes Review, titled Covert COVID Culprits, an Inquest Chronicle. And we, of course, have done a podcast discussing that book at length. I wrote a review of the book that you can find at both the OccidentalObserver.net and also my website, therealistreport.com. It's going to be in the book and movie review section of the website. And I would highly encourage people to pick up a copy of the book if you haven't already, especially if you're interested in who was really sort of orchestrating this whole COVID scamdemic situation and who continues to. Who was I speaking with just the other day I was on another program with Giuseppe called The Sane Asylum, and we were talking about the new CDC director, who's this woman, I think it's Mindy Cohen, who's also Jewish. She took over from Rochelle Walensky. So, there's a lot of very, very high-level Jews involved in this COVID scamdemic, and your book does a great job, you know, thoroughly laying this all out and providing all the details and the facts and the background information. So I'd encourage people to check that out.
Yeah, and I wrote an essay about Mandy Cohen called Passing the Talmud Torch. That's on Substack and UNS Review. I don't think that one made it to Occidental Observer. Well, I think it might have.
Okay. Well, yeah, you can find it pretty much. I mean, I follow your work mostly through Taboo Truth. You know, you can go there and find all your stuff. It also gets published other places as well, but you can always find it at Taboo Truth. And if you just like search Taboo Truth Substack, it'll come right up. I think the actual URL is carlhamers.substack.com. And I'll, of course, have a link specifically, like directly to your Substack when I post this podcast program for anybody interested. And I'll also have a link to pick up a copy of your book as well. Now, I know you're quite a busy man. Today we're going to talk about the latest issue of the Barnes Review magazine, which is, of course, the September-October 2023 issue. And that includes a great article you wrote titled, Did Hitler Seize Power or Was He Elected Democratically? And this issue turned out great. I mean, I find myself repeating that about the Barnes Review, and it's I think it's objectively true. If anybody that's a subscriber and actually gets the magazine, they always turn out outstanding. The artwork is great. The layout is great. The articles are great. We've got a lot of good contributors. The content is top-notch, and it's really, you know, one of the last revisionist publications in existence in this modern day. And again, it's not an easy thing to do to maintain a print publication of any nature, let alone one dealing with, you know, politically incorrect history and bringing history into accord with the facts, which is the, you know, sort of the motto of the Barnes Review. So I wanted to start off and just encourage our listeners to consider subscribing to the magazine if they are not already. As I mentioned, it's really like a one-of-a-kind publication, one of the last remaining history magazines featuring articles from a dissident revisionist perspective. And each issue each issue is 80 pages. It's basically like a small book. Some of the issues that we do are like expanded issues, and they'll run up to 120, 112 pages, depending on you know, the particular issue. But generally, each issue is about 80 pages. And if you're interested in authentic real history, you really should be subscribing to the magazine. And you can find all of those details at barnesreview.org. There's also an 800 number that you can call toll-free and you know, actually speak to somebody in the office and pick up a subscription. There's a number of different ways to subscribe. We also have a digital subscription if anybody's interested in that, where you can actually log into the website and download like a PDF of the entire magazine. I like to have an actual print copy. I've been a subscriber since like 2012 or 2013, I think, when I first heard Michael Collins Piper talk about the Barnes Review, and I have been a very satisfied customer ever since. So anyways, I wanted to mention that and just encourage people to go out and get a subscription to the magazine if they're not, you know, if they don't already have one. And Carl, I know you got your issue mailed to you. I got mine like literally like September 1st, like the first day of September, I think it arrived, or maybe even like the last day of August. It came out like right on time, which was perfect timing. It's sometimes it's kind of hard to get it, you know, to where it's like arriving like right on the first of the month, but this issue worked out perfectly. I'm just curious, what'd you think? I mean, just the overall assessment of the issue. We're going to talk about some more of the like articles in more detail, and certainly your article in more detail, but I'm just curious your first impressions looking at the cover and taking a look at the magazine.
Oh, I'm always impressed and, you know, fascinated with the fine details of hidden history. You know, there's very few essays in the Barnes Review that are general history. They discover these hidden backwaters of history, of which World War II has many, that people have never heard about. Of course, everyone's heard of Nazi book burning, but the cover article got into the fine details of that, and I learned some things I didn't know. Like you said, we can talk about each essay separately, but overall, just the overall structure of the magazine, which includes the news you might have missed and the letters to the editor. There was even a photo section on these sort of indigenous peoples around the world. There's almost nothing but photos, so it has some very interesting features.
Yeah, well, it's actually history you may have missed. That's kind of like a feature of the magazine that we've been doing for a long time. It's like sort of like a short snippet of various news items related to revisionism or history or, you know, persecution of revisionists. That's been a big part of it as well. And then also you mentioned the Hidden Album of Mankind, which was actually on page 56 and 57 of this current issue. I'm going to flip to it right now. And boy, some incredible photos of people from all over the world. And, you know, you take a look at these photos and you hear these, like, totally, like, disconnected from reality, like, far-left activists talk about how race is a social construct. And you look at these photos and it's like, I think just looking at these images demonstrate that race is very much a reality. And it's not simply just different, you know, tones of skin. It's all sorts of, you know, physical features that are noticeably different among different groups of people. And that photo collage really gives a good representation of that, I think.
Some of the people there didn't look fully human. Excuse me.
Right. I know it.
No, but there's,
but yeah,
there's
no,
pictures
that was
throughout
a good section.
The articles. And I think Paul Angel is the, you know, the investigator who finds all these photos, and some of them are really unusual. For instance, I'd always learned that there were only two photos of National Socialist book burnings, both from the same incident. But that turned out not to be true. There were some pictures in that essay that showed the book burnings from other perspectives. There were book burnings in other places. And so it found what I imagined were pretty rare photographs.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. And we'll talk much more about the that lead article. Let me just actually start off. I'll just give a recap of all the main articles published in this issue. And of course, as we're talking about here, it's the main one is titled "A Revisionist Analysis of Third Reich Book Burnings," and that was written by John Weir, who is one of the leading like dissident revisionist historians in America today, I'd say. I mean, I don't know if there's an aspect of World War II history he has not addressed in great detail. His articles are very, very easy to read, easy to digest, easy to get through. You know, it's not superly overly academic or overly intellectual or anything like that. They're very almost short, concise, like bullet point type articles that really give you a proper understanding of some of these more controversial aspects of World War II. And this is one of them. He did a great job with this article, I think. So that's the lead article. That's what the cover of the magazine is all about. The second article is your piece, Carl, that we're going to talk more about as well. It's called "Did Hitler Seize Power, or Was He Elected Democratically?" And it sort of addresses this idea that you often hear in mainstream circles that Hitler seized power and, you know, is just like this very tyrannical, authoritarian type regime, which I don't think is true at all. And so you kind of dispel that myth in this piece. And then we have a piece by Mark Rowland, who wrote about, basically the article was all about World War II Imperial Japan's nuclear weapons program. And we'll have more to say about that as well, you know, as we proceed here. I know in previous podcasts we've talked about our mutual suspicion that nuclear weapons may in fact be a hoax. So we'll talk more about that. I thought the article was really interesting at the very least. Who knows exactly what's going on with these nuclear weapons programs? I'm very skeptical, as I think you are as well. But
Yes.
the article itself was pretty interesting, nevertheless. And then we have a piece by Ronald Ray, who's also a longtime contributor to the magazine. He wrote a book review of "Crimes Discreetly Reve- or sorry, Crimes Discreetly Veiled," which was written by a very prominent British historian, F.J.P. Veal. And I think it was written in like the late ni- or like the mid 1950s originally, if I'm not mistaken. And the Barnes Review has reissued it, and I have not actually read the book, but it looks very, very interesting. It's another sort of like revisionist analysis of many of the key deceptions related to World War II, including many events that most Americans probably wouldn't even know about today. So that was a really interesting article, and that's a very interesting book that is also available from the Barnes Review if anybody's interested.
Can
Like
I
I,
say now? Can I say
yeah.
now, John? I read that book more than a year ago. I was attracted to the author because I'd read his other book, "Advance to Barbarism," which was utterly fascinating. It was one of those books that left an impression that, you know, reframed my perception of history and life. It was really, really revelatory, that "Advance to Barbarism." So I was wanting to read more of FJP Veal.
And FJP Veal, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was like a very prominent like aristocrat in Britain, right? That was very connected to like the political elite and, you know, had a lot of like insider knowledge and information about what was going on at the highest levels of the government, right?
Oh, I'd have to revisit the biography of Veal. I don't recall his status in society, or he might have been a professor. I don't recall.
Okay, no worries. I'm pretty sure. I'm trying to think here. I could probably flip to it. Anyways, yeah, he was definitely a very prominent historian, nevertheless, and had a lot of important things to say about World War II. So that was Ronald Ray's review of that book. Very, very good piece. And then we had a piece by Antonius Patrick, who wrote part three. I think this is the con yeah, this should be the concluding article of a three-part series dealing with the Vatican, the Rothschilds, and usury. So it's kind of addressing all of these topics from a traditional Catholic type perspective. A pretty interesting article. And then he also wrote sort of a follow-up to it, a shorter piece on Frank Chodorov's solution to the debt ceiling debacle. And Chodorov, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, he was like this kind of like libertarian type thinker, economist. Pretty interesting article. I'm a little bit skeptical of libertarianism in general and that sort of like mindset, but I often find that they have a very sound analysis of like foreign affairs and even, you know, like monetary policy in general.
A lot of the
But I
libertarians
try not,
were
yeah.
Jews.
Well,
Murray
and this
Rothbard and Milton Friedman.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. And this guy, Frank Chidorov, was as well. He
Oh.
was, he was also Jewish, if I'm not mistaken. I'm almost positive. I could actually, in fact, I'll Google it really quick, but I'm pretty sure he was.
That informs my hesitancy about libertarianism.
Yeah, definitely he was right here on Wikipedia. He was the 11th child of Russian Jewish immigrants. Well, nevertheless, he did have some interesting things to say about economics, and it's not necessarily worth just totally discarding, but I guess I just try not to get like tied up in the weeds with like all these economic issues. I mean, to me it's pretty simple. You
What made
can't.
that interesting to me, John, was it wasn't a month or more ago when the Congress was considering raising the debt ceiling once again,
Yeah, they do this every
as
so
if there was
often.
this, as if there was any question or this is a real issue and we're agonizing over it. It's like we know that's all theater. They always choose to raise it. There's never a vote against.
Yeah,
It's a
exactly.
theater. So that made this particular essay really timely.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree. I mean, 'cause yeah, that does come up every, it's like every election cycle. They'll have this big like political spectacle where they're debating the debt ceiling and should we raise it, should we not raise it? Yeah, it's all more or less nonsense, I think.
As if there's any suspense.
Yeah, exactly. So that was an interesting piece. And then we had, in my view, this was may have been one of the more interesting articles in this issue, mainly because I did not really know anything about this topic. And that is the piece by Remy Tremblay, our French Canadian correspondent. He's also been a longtime contributor to the Barnes Review. And he wrote about the tragic fate of the Pied Noirs in Algeria. And they were, the Pied Noirs were basically mostly French. I think there were some German and some Dutch and some other European settlers in Algeria, but most of them were French. And there were hundreds of thousands of French, like ethnic French people that lived in Algeria. Settling in Algeria, I want to say like in the early 1900s. I'm going to actually set up an interview with Remy to talk much more about his article and about this period of history. Again, one that I was really not familiar with at all. Certainly not the uprising, which, based on his article, what I read, it was like this radical sort of like almost Marxist inspired, like anti-white revolution, basically. And tons of French natives were, like ethnic French in Algeria were massacred and murdered during the course of this period, which really kind of began in the 1960s. The 1960s were a very, very tumultuous decade, to say the least, and including in Algeria and other parts of Africa.
Yes, and John, if I can say, I was recently listening to your, previous interview with John Massaro, who was talking about his personal memories of the 60s and 70s, and he mentioned the brutal massacre, the hacking to death with machetes of the Portuguese people in Angola that happened immediately after the Congo, the Belgian Congo, was released as a colony and turned over to the Congolese, which sounded very reminiscent of this very same thing in Algeria with the Pied Noir.
Definitely. I mean, this was all happening like right about the same time, I think.
Yes.
And this is, again, this is another aspect of history that really needs a proper revision. Written from, basically our sort of perspective. And this is a step in that direction. There's much more that could be written about, decolonization and some of these like more radical, like anti-European type revolutionary movements in Africa and other parts of the world. But yeah, this article I thought was turned out very, very good. And like I said, I'm gonna hopefully set up an interview with Remy Tremblay in the next couple weeks. I know I'm gonna be interviewing Michael Santomaro, who was featured in the final article in this current issue of the Barnes Review, the September-October 2023 issue, where we did a like a written Q&A with Michael Santomaro, who is currently the CEO of Castle Hill Publishers, which is the publishing house originally founded by the German revisionist Germar Rudolph. Probably one of the most important revisionist publishers, is certainly in America, and the Barnes Review and Castle Hill Publishers have not necessarily teamed up, but kind of, or, you know, are sort of working together to get some of these books back in print. I mean, that's the thing, like with modern like publishing, like if you get shut down by Amazon or by Ingram Content Group, it's like almost impossible to get your books back into operation, or, you know, back into publication. So that's what TBR is kind of helping out in that regard with Castle Hill Publishers. And it's good. I love seeing that, you know, being able to work with other organizations like that, you know, in a sort of mutually beneficial way. You know, cause again, this is, this sort of publishing is definitely not the most easy thing to do, obviously. I mean, publishing in general is a pretty difficult business in our current era with everything going online and being digital. So, yeah, it was good. And the interview was kind of focused on the purpose of Castle Hill, the importance of revisionism. We talked about Michael Santamoro's sort of background and introduction to the concept of revisionism and just how important it is, and sort of issues relating to free speech and free intellectual inquiry and that sort of thing. So I thought that turned out really, really good. I'm going to interview him as well in the next week or so. So we'll be hearing much more from Michael Santamaro.
Yeah,
and he's been sort of involved in revisionism for a while. So he's got a lot of experience. He's got a lot of knowledge, and
he's got a lot of courage.
Right, a lot of courage. Yeah,
step in where Grandma Rudolph used to be. I want to say, if there's one thing that I would have liked to see better with this particular edition, I would have liked to know the dollar number of the Operation Book Rescue fundraising. I sent in $50 to that cause, and I would, you know how fundraisers often will set up a thermometer, and they'll say our goal is $100,000, and then the thermometer rises as the donations come in, and you see how close they get to the goal. But we didn't get any dollar number on Operation Book Rescue.
That's yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, that's actually a good idea. I will definitely pass that along and see if we can get any information about that, either maybe posted on the website or published in the next issue or something. But yeah, no, that is a good idea. And yeah, we'll see what we can do about that in the future.
Thank you.
But yeah, no problem at all. But needless to say, it is definitely a worthy endeavor, and trying to get some of these hidden and suppressed and censored books back into publication is certainly, in my view, a very worthy endeavor. And I think Castle Hill Publishers would completely agree with that. I mean, we got to get these books back into publication.
Well, my book is still on Ingram and it's still on Amazon. But at some point, someone's going to notice the topic, you know, the taboo topic. And I might have to rely on Operation Book Rescue.
Right. Well, I don't want to jinx you or anything, but that certainly wouldn't surprise me given the way things are going. You know, it's almost incredible it's lasted that long. So I guess just keep your fingers crossed and hopefully it stays on there for as long as possible. But it's almost like an inevitability. I mean, if you're publishing this sort of material, you're bound to run into, you know, a group like the ADL or any of these other, you know, sort of nonprofit groups that go around and just harass people, harass private companies to censor and ban people.
Yeah, no.
It's almost just a matter of time, right, before it happens.
Paul Angel advised me about the title of my book so that I could avoid the immediate, you know, attention. So maybe that'll carry on.
Yeah, you kind of got to be strategic with these sorts of things in this day and age. Well, and I mean, that kind of goes to the heart of the editorial that I wrote for this current issue. It's titled, Where's the Outrage for These Burned Books? And it sort of deals with, there's all these controversies lately, the past couple years anyways, most of them are like explicitly like Holocaust-themed books. Many of them are incredibly inappropriate for children, including the Anne Frank Diary. And I have an article pulled up here that was just published by the Jewish Telegraph Agency a couple days ago that we'll talk more about here in a second. But, I mean, really, that's the thing. There's been all this outrage about school districts and concerned parents expressing alarm at some of these very subversive Marxist-inspired books being presented to children and school, you know, school libraries, public libraries across the country. And again, many of them are in fact Holocaust-themed. A lot of them are promoting very sexually degenerate themes, just very inappropriate material for children. And so these parents that are, you know, upset about this are being demonized and tarnished as like these evil monsters that want to, you know, suppress literature and suppress important, you know, books from being read by children. It's just totally outrageous. Where's the outrage for the actual books that are being burned? Genuine, legitimate, scholarly, historical books that are being banned on Amazon, canceled off of Facebook, you know, you can't promote it anywhere, that sort of thing. So that's kind of what this editorial was sort of pointing out. And in fact, I don't know, do you want to, I don't know if you want to, if you have any comments about that or if you want to say anything, but I do want to, mention this article from the Jewish Telegraph Agency, but go ahead if you have any yes. comments.
Just very briefly, I thought it was clever of you to frame your editorial in this way with the cover article, you know, Nazi book burning, you know, when we look at that, the books that the National Socialists, mostly the student group, burned, were fully deserving of being burned. Pornographic filth and Marxist propaganda. And most people today, especially the mothers of the school children, would agree. But you frame this as, you know, there are books and materials that are fully, not just available today, but even celebrated and promoted that are fully deserving of being burned. And they're not. The one exception I would say you mentioned Ernest Hemingway and H.G. Wells as having been burned by National Socialist Germany, and that may be you're presenting that as maybe a, you know, overreaction. Maybe those books should not have been burned, but it turns out in the case of Wells, he was actually a Freemason and he went on to be a member of the Fabian Society. I've studied and I've written about Wells in my book about the Princeton Radio Project of October 30th, 1938, the War of the Worlds, you know, that was some of the early fear propaganda that was studied by the Council on Foreign Relations and the Rockefeller. And so Wells actually was a kind of subversive socialist, communist propagandist. And I think it was appropriate that the Germans burned his books.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Really, really well done. Editorial. I put everything in a great frame.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I wanted to also mention before I jump into this JT article, I wanted to mention the image and caption on page 11 of this opening article, the article by John Weir dealing with Nazi book burning, and it's an image of the total destruction of the Institute for Historical Review, which was basically like firebombed and like set ablaze by arsonists associated with the Jewish Defense League. And I think this happened, I want to say it was like in the 1980s.
July 4th, 1984.
Okay, yeah, right, exactly. We didn't have the exact date published in the magazine. We probably should have. That's, but I knew it was in the 1980s, yeah. And there was like $1 million worth of inventory that just went up in flames. And of course, you know, back then the Institute for Historical Review was one of the leading organizations publishing on the Holocaust, publishing revisionist perspectives about the Holocaust and World War II in general, I guess. And, you know, maliciously targeted in a criminal act of arson. And again, where's the outrage over this? I mean, a lot of people would have celebrated this act of terrorism, essentially, because of the, you know, they don't necessarily agree with the contents of the books. So, you know, just another example of the total hypocrisy and double standards on display here.
That was terror attack was conducted by the Jewish Defense League. They were designated a terrorist organization at the time. But not a big penalty against them. You know, there was some lawsuits, but minor. You know, slap right on the wrist.
Well, and I mean, most people wouldn't even know that this happened, you know, let alone, I mean, could you imagine if a bunch of, you know, right wing, you know, white nationalist type were to attack and set like the ADL building on fire or something like that? you know, everybody would know about it. It would be in the news for weeks and months on end. There'd be like a national day of remembrance, and they'd get all sorts of money from the federal government. They'd set up fundraisers and generate millions of dollars. You know, I mean, it would just be a totally different scenario if it were to happen in reverse. You know what I mean?
Yes, that's the power of the media to magnify or minimize, you know, bring things into a greater focus or totally dismiss them.
Right. Exactly.
It's Institute for Historical Review did very good work in revisionism. It's changed somewhat. It's still doing good work, but that was a major development in historical revisionism, 1984.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And take a look at the image. You know, anybody that's subscribing, flip over to page 11 and take a look at that. That's major destruction, major loss of all sorts of very important and scholarly, you know, intellectual books that just totally went up in flames. And again, most people wouldn't even know about this incident. Now I had mentioned the Jewish Telegraph Agency. I gotta just briefly read from this. This is sort of, to me, it's comical. This is an article that was published on September 19th, JTA.org. I can post a link to this when I post the podcast program. But the headline here is Texas teacher reportedly fired after reading from Anne Frank's diary to students. And it says here a middle school teacher in a district outside Houston, Texas, has been fired reportedly for reading a sexual passage from Anne Frank's diary out loud to eighth grade students, the district told local news. The passage came from a 2018 graphic version of the diary by the world-famous Jewish Holocaust victim that restored some portions of the initial book that had been cut from the most well-known editions. Anne Frank's diary, the graphic adaptation, has also been at the center of several other recent book-related controversies in public schools. It was briefly pulled from another Texas district, permanently removed from a Florida district, and has spent several months under review at another Florida district. A Republican Jewish lawmaker in Florida has called it Anne Frank pornography. And Carl, my question is, why in the world would this book even be in public schools to begin with, given its pornographic nature? There's some very inappropriate material in the Anne Frank diary, and yet this is presented as like essential reading to middle school students. I know even high school students, I think in some districts, it probably just depends on where you go to school. But this is a very, very well-known mandatory book in most school districts, right?
Oh, yes. Has been for a long time. In this case, the teacher was reading from sort of like a comic book version of the official school curriculum.
Well, I
but,
think
just finish.
Yeah.
Because there's more to this. So he was basically confronted for reading something that wasn't part of the original official school curriculum, but the school curriculum recommended the comic book for the students to read at home, and they also encouraged the teachers to provide other materials. And so he was really in the right to be reading from this. So I'm the editor of the book Unmasking Anne Frank, and I wrote the introduction and the postscript. That's issued by Clemens and Blair. I worked with Thomas Dalton on that. And the author is Ikuo Suzuki, a Japanese author. And he details the numerous pornographic and just grotesque content of the Anne Frank diaries. And in the postscript, I write about the five missing pages that emerged in 1998, and then the two uncovered pages that showed up in 2018. The two uncovered pages of the Anne Frank diary are the most grotesque, pornographic, just vile and wretched stuff. There's dirty jokes that Anne tells and sexual content. And she talks about how her father spoke with her about the whorehouses in Vienna. And she talks about what she would say if somebody approached her asking her about, you know, sexual topics. And, well, who's going to approach a 14-year-old girl and ask them about sex? Well, only a pervert or a, you know, a psychopath. Anne Frank is known to have, well, she says in the diaries that she's addicted to valerian pills, which are sedatives. The whole thing is just grotesque. So it's hard to answer your question, except, you know, why is this required in, for school children, except to say because somebody wants to degrade and pervert the minds and souls of children.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I look at it as basically like an intellectual attack on children. I mean, this book, and there's other Holocaust-themed books, that book Mouse, which is like a – that one actually is like a comic book-style graphic novel, and it's just like very subversive. I mean, there's like, you know, dead bodies and like just horrific imagery, sexual related content. And the Anne Frank diary, I know, doesn't she also talk about like, I mean, she talks about like male female genitalia, but doesn't she also make like lesbian like it themed like comments about how she's like attracted to other women and
yes,
or I guess other girls. I mean, I don't know how old, you know, she wasn't maybe a fully grown woman when this allegedly was written. So yes. I guess just the whole entire thing is just totally inappropriate. and I mean, in my opinion, let alone this more, what do they call it? The graphic adaptation, which is like a more complete version of the original diary, apparently, that included much more of this, scandalous, you know, sexually themed, sexually charged content. You know, it's just so inappropriate for children to be consuming this stuff. I mean, I think any normal, healthy parent would agree. You don't want your children exposed to this crap. It's unnecessary.
You wonder if this teacher was tilting in that direction. It was sort of like the mothers that were reading the vile pornography in the school libraries at those school board hearings, and then the commissioner of the school board hearing tries to shut her down. You're like, you can't say those kind of things in public. And the mother's like, well, that's the point. You know, if we can't say it in public among adults, it shouldn't be in books in the school library. And that, you wonder if this teacher was doing the same thing, trying to like bring attention to the inappropriate content of the Anne Frank diaries.
You know, I almost get that impression without knowing all the specific details. That is definitely my impression, though.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even like just really kind of just exposing what these kids are being subjected to. Did you see the controversy recently with Louisiana Senator John Kennedy, who was reading aloud from like one of these super sexually graphic books in Congress? Did you? I don't know if you caught that. Go ahead.
Kennedy, that Kennedy.
Senator John Kennedy. Yeah, like the Kennedys, like Kennedy.
I was looking up another name. No, I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was basically kind of doing like what his teacher did, and was reading aloud in, you know, like a public hearing, you know, addressing some of these very inappropriate, you know, books and material that are being either encouraged, you know, children are being encouraged to read them, or they're just available in the public library or the school library or whatever. And he's reading aloud from it. And it's just like disgusting. Like not even, I mean, very, first off, totally inappropriate for kids, but I would argue even inappropriate for adults. I mean, who is into this sort of thing? It takes a very, you know, twisted, like sick person to like want to go out and read this sort of crap. It's just disgusting filth. And he reads aloud from it, making this point, and yet he's demonized as like this bad guy, you know, just like this teacher is. You know, she's just openly reading what the school district is allowing kids to, you know, to read and encouraging them in some cases to read. It's outrageous. And that's the same with a lot of these other books. And this article actually even notes that most of these books that are causing all these controversies across the country, and, you know, parents are getting upset and, you know, they're fighting back and trying to get some of these books removed from the shelves. A lot of them are, as I mentioned, Holocaust themed, or they're written by Jews. There's a book called, I mentioned Mouse. There's another book called The Fixer, which Gosh, I can't remember the details of that one. I don't know if that's necessarily a Holocaust-themed book. I tend to think they sort of go hand in hand. Like, they all seem to be related to the Holocaust in some way. Oh, no,
There is a
actually, the
whole.
Fixer is about anti-Semitism and a Jew being targeted in Tsarist Russia in, like, the early 1900s. But so it's basically like an anti-Semitism theme rather than specifically dealing with the Holocaust. But basically, what do they all have in common? They're all more or less Jewish themed, either the Holocaust or persecution and racism and anti-Semitism and this sort of thing. And they're just entirely inappropriate for kids.
Yes, I mean there's a whole genre of Holocaust porn. The first nude bodies shown on movies or television were Holocaust victims. The first movie made after the Catholic, I forget the name of that group, they lobbied Hollywood to create the movie rating system, the GPGR. And this is kind of a Catholic League of Decency or something.
National Legion of Decency, I think it was called.
Yes, and
Catholic League of Decency, yeah.
they got laws passed to prevent like inappropriate content and what they call indecent material in Hollywood movies. And then the Jews were able to overturn that. And the first movie they made was showed like openly naked sexual scenes in a Holocaust movie.
Yeah, I know it. I know it's so tied into the Holocaust stuff too. It's very bizarre, and it shows you just, I mean, that's the whole point of this. It's like a psychological, like intellectual, like attack.
Yes.
It's like intellectual Bolshevism, just a full frontal attack on your mind.
Right, it's a culture war. It's straight out of the strategies of the protocols of Elders of Zion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's very true. Well, and I mean, this all, of course, ties into John Weir's article in the magazine, and he talks about all the different books and authors and sort of like the topics that they were censoring. And one thing, and I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but one thing that struck me, one of the most important points in the article, is that this was really not like a state-sanctioned, like top-down campaign to just randomly burn these books that the Nazis didn't like. A lot of it was sort of organized at the local level by student activist groups and others that were sympathetic to National Socialism. So it wasn't really like, at least at the beginning, and I don't know if it ever really was throughout its, throughout the National Socialist era, it wasn't like this top down, like Hitler's like ordering the all these specific books to be banned and burned and whatnot. It was sort of
No.
like a, yeah, exactly. It was that to me was like the biggest takeaway. It's like that whole idea that like Hitler was just like dictating what could and couldn't be read or published or consumed is just not true at all. This was like a very organic uprising against this total trash that was permeating German society, certainly in the aftermath of World War I and during the Weimar years.
I mean that would have fallen into the purview of Joseph Goebbels as the Minister of Enlightenment and Propaganda. But yeah, he wasn't involved really either. They didn't prevent it, they didn't stop it. But the article says these attempts were implemented in 1933 when National Socialist private militias proceeded to cleanse Germany of pornography originating from Jewish and Marxist elements. And then the students went on and got involved. It says that a committee of professional librarians in Germany submitted recommendations to the students for which books to burn.
Yeah, they had like a panel and like yeah, like a they were consulting all sorts of librarians and other, literary professionals to determine what, what was appropriate, what was inappropriate, what was subversive and undermining, the nation.
I just want to point out May 10th seems to be one of these special dates in history, like 9/11. The main book burnings occurred on May 10th, 1933, and by May 10th, 1934, some Jewish groups were establishing libraries to like preserve the burned books.
Yeah, I think they had one in New York set up and then one in Paris set up, the article notes.
The war in the West started on May 10th, 1940. There's a lot of May. That's the day that Winston Churchill took up the prime minister role. All May 10th. It's something about May 10th. But anyway, burn books.
You know what? Speaking of May 10th, now that you say that, I'm looking at the article, and we were talking about you had mentioned how there were Jewish-founded libraries to collect all these books. One of them was actually opened on May 10th, 1934.
Right.
Yeah, and that one was opened in Paris. And then a second one was called the Brooklyn Jewish Center, and that was established in New York to basically collect all of these quote-unquote Nazi banned books. So anyways, yeah, there's that date again. But the book – I mean, overall, like the books that were being quote-unquote burned or banned or whatever, they, I mean, most of them were dealing with pornographic or homosexual themes. There was actually John Weir goes through like a whole list of particular authors and like the themes that they wrote on that were censored or looked down upon or even banned. You know, like these anti-militarist type authors, pacifist, left-oriented novelists and critics, of course, communists. And yeah, basically like extremely partisan, like anti-national socialist type authors and historians and stuff like that. Of course, the founder of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, was top of the list, basically. Yeah, and then some of these quote-unquote scientists, these cultural Marxists, that were propounding an incomprehensible worldview epitomized by the outspokenly anti-Nazi physicist Albert Einstein. So anyways, these were the types of books that they were targeting, the types of themes that they were targeting. And frankly, I view it as a healthy response to this disgusting intellectual filth that was polluting society.
Oh, totally. Franz Boas was the subversive anthropologist. Kevin MacDonald writes about him in The Culture of Critique, you know, presenting the idea that race is a social construct and there's no biological basis to race. That was Jewish anthropologist Franz Boas. They burned his books. I mean, people in the know today would fully approve. I can talk when we talk about my essay, I'll mention the biography by Stolfi about Hitler, where Hitler multiple times openly declares his number one priority, along with the uplifting of the German people, is the eradication of Marxism. So this book burning was a major step in the influence of Marxist propaganda in Germany as part of the overall elimination of Marxism as a whole from the German nation and the German people.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
But Hitler didn't participate in it. He didn't promote it. He didn't organize it. That's the real revelation for normies. When they hear Nazi book burnings, they think, well, that came from the top down. But that was absolutely untrue. It came from the grassroots.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was really my big takeaway. I mean, this is kind of what I was mentioning, you know, to kind of introduce this topic. That was the most important aspect of this article, that, yeah, this was a very organic grassroots effort. It really didn't come from the top. It wasn't like dictated by Hitler or Goebbels or anybody else. It was sort of just an organic expression of the people outraged with the subversive communist nonsense polluting society.
We always have to mention Magnus Hirschfeld and the Institute for Sex Research. That's thought to be the main target of the students hauling out the books. But there were others. But you know, Magnus Hirschfeld went about dressed as a woman named Aunt Magnesia. And at one point, Hitler said he was the most dangerous man in Germany. I'd have to go look up my source for that, but I do recall reading that, you know, because of this subversion of basically the German family, the healthy relations between men and women, which was a national socialist, you know, sacred focus, nature, you know, like the national socialism was based on natural law. And there's probably nothing more natural than the healthy masculine feminine dynamic. And Hirschfeld was undermining and perverting that.
Right, absolutely. One thing that I also wanted to point out that was really sort of revelatory to me anyways, and it was something I guess I sort of knew, maybe I just didn't know the full extent of it or the full context, was, you know, like, quote-unquote Nazi book burning is, like, presented as, like, these tyrants in Germany, you know, burning all these innocent books, and, you know, there was... They just were suppressing these books because they were Jewish authors or whatever. They didn't totally agree with National Socialism, which of course was, I guess, true to a certain extent, but I think they had a lot of good reasons to target a lot of these books because they were just total trash. But one thing that's interesting is that in the aftermath of World War II, really the biggest book burners were the Allies in their occupation of Germany. I mean, they eliminated tens of thousands of books from Germany dealing with National Socialism and totally rewrote the history of the entire country. Carl, can you hear me?
Sorry, I was on mute.
Oh, okay.
Was that in your editorial, the post-war book burning?
Not really. It was actually in the article by John Weir. He makes that point at the very end to kind of conclude the article that, like, if we want to talk about who the actual book burners were, we need to look at the Allies, the Allied occupation, and, you know, the Americans, the British, the French, the Soviets. They systematically burned and eliminated all of these books that had been published during the National Socialist era, advocating a National Socialist type worldview.
Which turns out to be among the more wholesome and a good influence in books.
Exactly. So that was probably the second biggest revelation in this article. One, it wasn't this top-down thing that Hitler was, like, dictating. And two, the actual, I mean, if we want to be objective about the situation, the real book burners, the real censors were the Allies post-World War II, once Germany was defeated, which we see still being played out today. I mean, you know, you get Holocaust revisionist books banned on Amazon. You can't publish them. You can't get them in certain countries in Germany, certain countries in Europe and other parts of the world. I mean, it's literally a crime to even purchase this sort of material or to publish this sort of material in some of these countries. I mean, talk about censorship. That's genuine censorship right there.
Oh, that's why TBR had to hold the fundraiser.
Right
for the marginalized books.
Well, right, exactly. I mean, you know, if you get all this stuff banned on Amazon and, you know, any other platform that you can actually sell it, yeah, there's not you don't have a whole lot of options at that point.
There is that phenomenon that when people learn a book's been banned, they have more interest in reading it. It actually promotes banned books. But to restrict the production, the printing and distribution of books is, you know, it's hard to restrict the desire to read a banned book, but you can restrict access, or they can. So I think the desire is there. I think the interest is growing in National Socialist revisionist history, the whole World War II revision. And the people want those books if they can just find them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. There's definitely interest in it, for sure. And to me, that's a good thing, because we've been presented with one side of the story in a systematic fashion for generations at this point. So it's important to sit down and read what these guys had to say, to read what Hitler himself had to say, which is why because everything that he was saying, like in Mein Kampf, for example, is so spot on and eloquent and insightful and just powerful. It's like, no wonder they don't want you to read this, because he was right about everything.
Mm-hmm. The reading of Mein Kampf converted a number of people, including George Lincoln Rockwell.
Right, exactly. Well, you know what? Let's move on, because I do want to talk about your article in a little more detail here, and that's dealing with how Hitler actually came into power. And you sort of dispel this myth that he, like, seized power, or it was like this, you know, authoritarian, you know, power grab or a coup. I mean, you actually start off the article talking about the failed putsch attempt, which was a genuine, you know, coup attempt, I guess, although unsuccessful. Hitler, in fact, went to prison as a result of that failed putsch in 1923. But Well, I'll let you kind of provide some of the details. Did Hitler seize power, or was he elected democratically? And you have a sort of an interesting conclusion to answer that question, I think, in the article.
Yeah, spoiler alert, the title is a trick question. But I got the motivation to do the research and write this article when I was listening to an interview. I'm going to guess, maybe I shouldn't guess, but I think it was John Friend interviewing Mike King, and who's a revisionist, right? Mike King, The Bad War, quite a number of great books he's written. And in fact, I think he's the first beneficiary of the fund drive, the fundraiser. And I heard him say, forgive me if it was someone else, but one of our revisionist authors said Hitler seized power. And I kind of like slammed my fist on the, I went, the court historians, all the official, demonizers of Hitler say he seized power. But when our guys start saying it, we really have to get straight on this. So I got motivated to really dig into the details and present the actual coming to power of Adolf Hitler. How did he achieve that? And then, so I start with the so-called Beer Hall Putsch of December 9th, excuse me, November 9th, 1923, at a time of great crisis in Germany when the French had occupied the Ruhr Valley, where the German industrial, capacity was operating, which they needed to pay the reparations to the French. The French army marched into the Ruhr. It created a great crisis. And it also created a kind of unification of the country. All the different parties, including the Communist Party, joined together in a what they called a passive resistance. And that was promoted by the chancellor at the time, Gustav Stresemann, whose wife was the daughter of a Jewish financier, which did not endear him to Adolf Hitler. But Hitler refused to join the passive resistance. And he knew that it would lead to Marxist strikes in the Ruhr, and that would just promote and make the Marxist Party, the Communist Party of Germany, more popular, which indeed it did. And Hitler's great enemy was the Communist Party. So he held off from joining the passive resistance. And then they organized the putsch attempt. And it was a coalition. It wasn't just the National Socialists. There were 3,000 members of this group that marched through the streets of Munich. And they were headed towards the War Ministry, where Ernst Röhm had occupied the day before. Ernst Röhm was the leader of the SA, the Sturmabteilung, right? The Storm Detachment, the German security, excuse me, the National Socialist Security Forces. And they were fired upon by state police. There's a whole story there. Hitler was not hit by a bullet, but he did separate his left shoulder and even broke his upper arm. A guy named Ulrich Graf threw himself in front of Hitler, and he stopped six bullets that were aimed at Hitler and saved Hitler's life. The whole story, Hitler went to Hans Stegel's estate 35 miles outside of Munich and recovered, and he was considering committing suicide when Helen Hans Stegel convinced him to, that would be betrayal of the German people, and he should live on and survive his prison and come back and revive the party. She kind of guilt-tripped him, like he was betraying the German people. So that's an amazing story. That's not in my essay, but let's see here. 16 of the putsch marchers were killed, four state police. And after that, I just want to.
Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say briefly, and this particular putsch attempt had a major impact on the National Socialist movement, right? I mean, a lot of these guys were total heroes and martyrs of the cause, and they were later very much celebrated, in National Socialist lore, right?
Oh, yes. Afterward, after the National Socialist Party came to leadership, they declared a national holiday for that date, and they set up a memorial monument. But at the time, it was devastating to the National Socialist Party because they went to prison.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the party became dormant. Hitler sent a note to Alfred Rosenberg to try to keep the party alive, but they barely succeeded. But after that, Hitler said, here's where we get into like how Hitler really achieved power. He said he did not seek in any way to seize power in Munich by revolution. He had renounced forever coup d'etat by force. Henceforth, he would stick rigorously to the democratic reality, basing all power on the consent of the people, meaning voting. That was a quote from Leon de Grelle. So after this failed putsch attempt, he said, we're going the legal route. We're going politics, voting, totally upfront, legal and political.
Well, and I think he makes very clear, not only in his writings, but in his speeches and stuff, he was trying to win over the German people, not just conservatives or more right-wing Germans. He wanted to convince and get everybody on board, including the communists, yes, including the socialists. He wanted, yes, to unite German society behind this movement that was a healthy expression of German nationalism and socialist principles, which I know most Americans have that leaves a very bad taste in the mouths of most Americans, given the way socialism or socialist has been so sort of distorted and it's like this weaponized word at this point. But basically all that meant was a recognition that everybody in society, from the average laborer all the way up to a professor or a businessman or a politician, everybody has a role to play in making the nation work and in creating a successful economy, a successful society. That's really like the sort of socialist principles that they were all about.
Yes, the meritocracy. And Hitler was convinced that he could convert the Communist Party members and the Social Democrats to National Socialism. And he was having some success with that in his speeches throughout the early 30s. And, those who wouldn't convert, they could go to the re-education camps because they were too dangerous to allow in German society. Mm. And that's what he proceeded to do. In the essay, I present the voting trajectory. For instance, in 1928 was the low point of National Socialist voting. They only got 12 deputies in the Reichstag. But by 1930, they increased that by 8 times. They placed 107 deputies in the Reichstag. That was the number 2 party behind the Social Democrats. And then by 1933, they won 33% of the vote and had the largest number of deputies. 1932. And 1932 was also the year that Adolf Hitler ran for president. Now, we have to understand some of the political laws in Germany at the time. The president, and this is the giveaway, the president appoints the chancellor. And there are certain requirements for a chancellor to be a candidate for appointment. And the percentage of that chancellor's party in the parliament is one of those parameters. So the National Socialists won 33%. They were by far the largest party in the Reichstag in 1932. Hitler won 36% of the presidential vote, and von Hindenburg won the rest. So that was a loss for Hitler as president. But it was enough to compel von Hindenburg to appoint Hitler chancellor. Okay, so these are just some, right, of the laws in effect at the time, and that plays into Hitler's strategies, in winning these vote counts.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting, and another thing that I wanted to just mention. By the way, are you familiar with a book called Why Hitler Came into Power by Theodore Abell?
I've never even heard of it.
Okay. It's a really interesting book. It was published in like 19, I think 1986, actually. Basically, Abell, I think, was a professor at Columbia University, one of the more prestigious universities in America, and they collected a bunch of essays that like average supporters of the National Socialist German Workers' Party submitted. They had like a writing competition, like explaining like what motivated you to get involved with this movement that during the late 1920s, early 1930s, was very much demonized by the mass media, certainly by the German state. It was very persecuted. You know, basically the book makes a very strong case that not only were there very legitimate motivating factors that led a lot of people from all different segments of German society to ultimately support Hitler and the National Socialists, but also that these guys worked tirelessly to overcome overcome this persecution, to reach out and really, sort of reach the masses of people and explain and articulate this political idea that they had. And it wasn't like they just seized power or like all of a sudden they were popular. I mean, they worked tirelessly for over 10 years to get to this point where Hitler was finally in a position to potentially be appointed chancellor. Right? I mean,
Oh,
it wasn't something that
yeah.
just happened overnight, and it wasn't this like violent, coup or seizure of power or something like that. I mean, they fought day and night for the hearts and minds of the German people, in many cases facing extreme persecution at the hands of the German state, at these very violent Marxist Bolshevik type groups that were violently disrupting their meetings and attacking them in the street. I mean, think about like you see the Antifa people
Yes,
today.
exactly.
Attacking Trump supporters. The same thing was going on in Germany, probably on a whole other level, on a much more violent level. There was
Yes.
basically a low-scale civil war taking place in Germany at this time.
And that's what the SA was developed to do. It was a self-defense. Self-defense is not violence. It was the Marxists and the Social Democrats, these gangs in the streets, and they'd infiltrate the meetings and start brawls. And the SA was often outnumbered. I should mention, one of the main sources I use as a reference for this article is R.H.S. Stolfi's book, Hitler Beyond Evil and Tyranny. It's a relatively new biography published in 2011, and it gives a good account of all this. I also want to mention the book, The Rise of the NSDAP, published by Antelope Hill, but written by the NSDAP at the time. It's a kind of a relatively short book about really the history of the development and rise of the NSDAP. So it also has some of this information about the voting record and these violent civil war, essentially, this gang warfare between the SA and the Marxists and the Social Democrats. It was absolutely brutal, and far more of the SA and the National Socialists were killed in these battles than the Marxists. Hitler disallowed the SA from having firearms, and some of them defied that order in certain situations. But this is how much, the National Socialist Party won through into power, not by seizing it, by an effort of will, by a unbending determination to overcome all obstacles. And the obstacles were extraordinary. It's part of the epic saga of the National Socialist Party, which really only began when they took power. But it was sort of like the Odyssey, where there's this tremendous struggle just to get home, and once you get there, now your real struggle begins. And that's
Right,
really good.
exactly.
I really recommend The Rise of the NSDAP from Antelope Hill. But Stolfi's book has a lot of great information as well, and I relied on it quite a lot for this essay. I could say more about that because I picked through it. I just went through the index to find the sections I needed for the essay because I was kind of under short notice. The deadline was coming up, and I wanted to get it into the magazine. But since then, I've been reading it page by page, and it's absolutely awesome. It's just a tremendous resource for the honest history.
Yeah, that's one book that I've never read, but I've heard many people talk about how important of a book it is.
Oh, really? I just came upon it.
The book that you're talking about, the biography of Hitler?
It was in the library that I inherited, so I was very interested in reading it. It's kind of a he says directly it's basically a rebuttal of the official biographers, including Bullock, who wrote the book Hitler, A Study in Tyranny. It's almost a direct refutation of those depictions of Hitler. And also Ian Kershaw has a more recent biography. No, this is very good, especially for people new to this kind of revisionism. It contrasts the official biographers with Stolfi's perception, which is, you know, Hitler as a kind of nobody, psychopathic narcissist versus Hitler as a prophet and a messiah, which is quite a contrast. But Stolfi makes a very good case for the Hitler as messiah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, was there any other points you'd like to make about this article, about Hitler allegedly seizing power or being appointed into power or being elected democratically? Was there any other final comments or points you wanted to make?
Just a final thought that even though Stolfi himself uses the word seize, and perhaps Mike King used it, in a vague sense, it could be considered appropriate because it required extraordinary effort and willpower and determination. But it's wrong to use it because it's so misleading, because the defamers of Hitler and the National Socialist Party use it to suggest a kind of violent, non-legal, non-political, you know, illegal approach to power. And in the end, the answer in the title is neither. Hitler did not seize power, and he was not elected. He was appointed to the chancellor role by President von Hindenburg.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. So kind of, it's like a neither question, as you said, it's sort of a trick question at the beginning. Yeah. No, it's a good article. It definitely dispels a lot of these myths and kind of gives an, you know, more, authentic background of how Hitler actually became Chancellor of Germany. A very important topic, I think, especially when all we hear about is how he was this tyrant, this monster, this, you know, authoritarian leader. Of course, none of that is really true. So, yeah, I think you did a good job dispelling a lot of these myths.
Let me mention one more point, if I can find it in my notes. It says just to state it myself, Hitler and the National Socialist Party approved of authoritarian democracy, and they denounced and disapproved parliamentary democracy. In other words, the majority, large majority of the people voting an authoritarian government into power is still democracy. This is a point that very few people seem to understand. They think of an authoritarian government as only tyrannical. But if the people vote for it in a democratic process, then it's not. And this was particularly appropriate for Germany. They thrived very well under a autocracy, you know, with reliable and loyal leaders. But they basically executed, if that's the word, they imposed authoritarian rule, but in a benevolent way, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Well, and one of the main critiques that Hitler always makes about democracy, like Western liberal parliamentary democracy, is that there's no one is ever held accountable. Like the political leaders are just, you know, and you see this on full display in America today. I mean, everybody's blaming the other party or blaming another political leader. There's no accountability, whereas in, you know, a more authoritarian type system, you have one person in charge, one party in charge. If something goes wrong, guess whose fault it is, and guess who's going to take the blame. So there's much more like a deeper sense of like accountability and responsibility for making sure things are happening and, you know, the nation's needs are being met. So right. Something that's totally lacking, and it has been lacking probably my entire life, you know, observing American politics. There is absolutely no accountability in American politics. It's absurd.
And
it's
almost
a
no
joke.
Cooperation.
It's a disgrace. Yeah.
Almost no cooperation. Hitler learned this about the Austrian parliament. It's in Mein Kampf. When he was in Austria, he attended some of the parliamentary sessions. He said these people can't cooperate with each other. They can't get anything done. And especially true when there's a communist party in the parliament, which there was in Germany, of course. They see to it that the government can't cooperate. And that's why an authoritarian single party leadership was so effective.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, we're going to have to wrap up here in just a few minutes, but I know we wanted to talk about maybe a couple other issues in this magazine, including, did you want to make any comments about the article dealing with the Japanese nuclear weapons program during World War II?
Yes, well, you know, of course, it's of great interest, all of the super weapons development towards the end of the war, particularly by the Germans, which they succeeded at. Jet engine, the nerve gas, the V2 liquid rockets, but there's a lot of accounts of course, the Germans trying to develop a nuclear bomb, and then the Americans soon after that. And apparently, we're told the Americans succeeded, and the Germans failed. And here's a new. This was new to me that the Japanese were trying to develop a nuclear weapon. They're in the similar situation as Germany. They need super weapons because they're outgunned by conventional weapons and manpower. But I guess since we have limited time, I'll just jump to my critique of this, not just some of the references in the article itself, but the whole theme of nuclear weapons. You and I have interviewed before based on my essay on Substack, Nuke Mongering Again, where I present with, you know, just the general possibility that nuclear bombs are a kind of hoax. They're a kind of a psychological operation to promote fear. And with obvious like military strategy applications, but that they may never have really developed the technology, not the Germans, not the Americans, not the Japanese. So this essay relies, 14 of its 27 footnotes come from a single book, Robert Wilcox, Japan's Secret War. It was published by Marlowe and Company, and I tried to see if that was a Jewish publisher, but they're out of business. It's been bought by Permuter Publishing, and a new edition is out in 2019. That's owned by Post Hill Press, which is founded and operated by Anthony Zicardi. I couldn't see if he was Jewish, but Post Hill Press offers a line of books for Jewish readers. The Wrong Jew, Defeating Those Who Want Us Dead, and then The Holocaust Holiday, One Family's Descent into Genocide Memory Hell by Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. So I think Permuter is owned by a Jewish publisher. So, you know, that's always suspect for me. I always look to see who the publisher is. So often they're Jewish. But, you know, at the time it was Marlowe and Company. So, and that's the edition that the author is relying on. Was it Roland? Mark Roland?
Yes.
Right. Thank you. So I found a PDF of the book. Japan's Secret War. And I searched it for Hitler and Jews. And I just to get a sense of whether it's revisionist. And it clearly is not. This is not from a revisionist perspective. It's more of a mainstream, negative propaganda and philo-Semitic. So I just felt like that source was perhaps suspect, not as reliable as a real revisionist source. And in footnote number 14, Roland quotes Simon Gunson, Japan's Eibon Project, which is an online article which I could not find. But I did find a WordPress site that Gunson operated, but it only had one essay. And I thought it was very suspect. It was a story of how a British unit towards the end of the war like found out the Nazi secret laboratory where they were developing their A-bomb and other wonder weapons. And among the commandos that invaded this German laboratory was Ian Fleming, the author of James Bond. So, you know, okay, you know, maybe that's true. Maybe even Fleming fought in World War II. I know that Orwell fought in the Spanish Civil War. So, but I just went around looking through some of the references, and I found some of them perhaps unreliable or not oriented from a revisionist standpoint. And just to finish, maybe I should write it up. I guess we don't have time, but I took notes throughout the article on, you know, factors that indicated the possibility that nuclear bombs are as a whole, like a propaganda development, a kind of psychological operation to frighten people, and including the development of the Japanese nuclear bomb. You know, even just looking at the cover of the book, there's a picture of a mushroom cloud in the background, and it's clearly fake. You know, not that he's depicting it as necessarily a real picture, because it's the cover, but it was indicative of the explosion couldn't have happened in the way that's shown in the picture.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that kind of goes to a lot of the heart of the the nuclear skeptics, their analysis of like the video footage and the imagery associated with alleged nuclear explosions.
Oh, yes, definitely. Some of the pictures clearly looked photoshopped and or whatever technique was used at the time. But I made quite a few other notes. The U-boat that the Germans were attempting to transfer nuclear material to Japan towards the end of the war, because the Japanese requested it, the U-boat was number U-234. And the uranium, of course, is U-235. So it seemed like a strange coincidence. One of those little details of these stories that make them suspect in my mind. And it goes on. Pretty much in the end, you get the idea that this article actually said the United States could not have developed their bombs in time if they hadn't confiscated the uranium from the German submarine that was on its way to Japan. So again, you get the idea, well, basically the Germans bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Or, you know, it's like, it's in a way, it blames the Germans again for something. Some major atrocity, because it was their uranium that the Americans used to finish out their bombs. I just find that, John.
That's an interesting take. I see the point you're making, but yeah, I guess I didn't really think about that when I was reading the article. But no, I mean that's a valid point. Yeah, it is sort of an underhanded. It's like, oh, even Nagasaki and Hiroshima are the result of, you know, the Germans. For somehow it's always the Germans' fault for everything, right?
Well, that's kind of my point. And it wasn't overtly stated, but it was kind of a suggestion.
No, yeah, I get what you mean. Yeah, it definitely wasn't overtly stated or anything, or even hinted at or alluded to, but I could see how you could take it that way.
One other, you know, it's similar to the Anne Frank diary. It's just like seemed incongruous was the Japanese were so desperate to develop a nuclear weapon. And the timeline was short. They were really struggling before the Allied invasion of Japan. And apparently, according to the essay, they did develop one, and they tested it on an island off Korea. Uh-huh. And I was thinking to myself, if I'm desperate to develop a super weapon, wouldn't I test it on the enemy? and they only had one at the time. It's like, you're going to waste the one that you've made with such great effort on a test? Wouldn't you test it on the enemy? Just thinking strategically.
Right, yeah, no, interesting point, yeah.
But apparently they went on to develop a few more. And once again, like in so many of the stories of nuclear bombs, we were just like an hour away from setting off the bomb, and then the Allies, the heroic Allies, rode in on white horses and raided the hangar where the bomb was getting ready to be deployed and stopped it from going off. You know, so often it's like we were just minutes away from a nuclear explosion, but it didn't quite happen. That was true of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it seems so suspect. Like we get so close, but we never really have a nuclear bomb explosion. But the suspense and the fear is built up.
Well, and you sort of see that even going on right now with this whole situation in Ukraine and the conflict, the broader conflict between the collective West and Russia, how it could potentially turn nuclear. I mean, there was even op-eds being written by these bloodthirsty neocon Jews basically saying that the U.S. needed to give Ukraine a nuclear weapon, or even potentially, you know, use nuclear weapons against Russia to, you know, to end this conflict. And again, of course, I'm skeptical of the concept of nuclear weapons, if they even truly exist. That doesn't mean that we don't have very advanced weaponry and, you know, very destructive bombs that we could use, but the whole nuclear weapons thing seems just to be much more of sort of like a fear-based PSYOP type program.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, here's a quote from the article, which quotes another article. The Japanese destroyed unfinished atomic bombs, secret papers, and atomic bomb plans only hours before the advanced units of the Russian army moved into Korea, the site of the project. So here again, we have like, well, yes, the Japanese were developing a nuclear weapon, but when we went to find their documents, well, they were destroyed. So we don't actually have the documents, you know, it just seems so suspect. And
it's so convenient for those actually looking for concrete proof of nuclear weapons. It's like, oh, we just so happened to lose all the document, or, you know, we had to destroy all the documents. We had to get rid of all the evidence.
Like the tapes of the moon landing. Let's see. I think even towards the end of the article, it says the Americans destroyed all their, it was in the national security interest too. The United States and Japan purposely covered up the story in order to protect what were perceived then during the post-war era as national interests. Covered up the story. It's like, okay. The next section is official cover-up of nukes. It's like, well, there's evidence, but there's no evidence. I don't want to be, you know, that down on Roland. He attempted to write a historically factual account, and he had some sources, and it can be very hard to perceive through these illusions, these psychological operations and war propaganda, really.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know what? Honestly, I to me, it's an interesting article. Nevertheless, I mean, you know, like I said, I have questions about the very feasibility of nuclear weapons, and, you know, whether they're actually even a legitimate weapon of war. But the article itself is definitely worth reading and is interesting. And that's the thing about, you know, a magazine like TBR is there's going to be stuff published in there that maybe not everybody would necessarily agree with.
Right, exactly. And it's worth debating them. I think that's true of my essays too. There's some aspects of that that I might have gotten wrong or failed to identify the source as less than accurate, and we should debate that.
Right, absolutely.
That's a key point of a historical revision, and it maintains our credibility.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Carl, thanks, man. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. This was a great conversation, as I knew it would be. And I know you've got all sorts of stuff you're working on, so keep up the great work. And we will do this again in the near future.
Thank you, John. Good to talk with you once again. Look forward to it next time.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Have a good one. I'll talk to you soon.
Good day.